I want you to imagine something for a second. Imagine you have spent years, I mean literally years, mastering this incredibly complex, highly mathematical skill.
Right.
You do this in a sterile, perfectly controlled laboratory. You calculate every variable, you eliminate every possible margin of error, and you finally produce your masterpiece. It is flawless.
The dream scenario.
Exactly. But then, right before it dries, a dog just wanders into the lab and steps right in the middle of it. So is your project completely ruined? Or, counterintuitively, has that accident just elevated it into something transcendent?
Oh, man. I mean, it is the ultimate nightmare for anyone who values control. We spend our entire lives trying to mitigate risk.
Right.
And suddenly, risk just becomes the central feature of the work.
Yeah, and that exact tension is what brings us to the subject of today's deep dive. We are looking at a 2021 abstract painting called Okash.
A fascinating piece.
It really is. It's a 20 by 20 inch poured acrylic canvas created by the artist Jairo Duque. And we have a great stack of sources to guide us today, including the artwork's highly detailed technical dossier, a rigorous visual analysis of the painting's actual surface, and the artist's own reflective text, which is titled Trastio Pintura Artistica.
And our goal today is to pull from all of those documents to explore this ultimate showdown. We're looking at the intense friction between meticulous, almost obsessive technical mastery on one hand, and the completely unpredictable power of creative accidents on the other.
Right.
We want to see how a random, totally non-human event might actually define the true artistic value of a piece.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we can even begin to understand the accident that made the specific painting famous, we have to talk about the canvas itself.
We do.
The preparation described in the dossier, I mean, it reads closer to chemical physics than traditional painting. I know we are dealing with poured Liquitex acrylics, but how hard is it really to pour paint onto a square?
Well, it is incredibly difficult when you actually understand the medium. Hmm. We aren't talking about casually squeezing paint onto a palette and, you know, brushing it on.
Right. It's not a watercolor class.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We are talking about high-stakes fluid dynamics here. Duque is manipulating liquid polymers. So the absolute biggest threat when you're pouring brilliant yellows, vibrant reds, and deep blacks onto a single surface is that the pigments will just, like, bleed together.
Because they're all wet at the same time.
Right. When differing molecular weights of pigments, like, say, a really heavy carbon black and a delicate cadmium yellow, when they collapse into each other, they actually block the refraction of light.
So instead of a vibrant composition, you just get, you know, a swamp on the canvas.
Yeah, the dreaded chromatic mud.
Yeah.
If you do not have immense chemical and physical control over your mediums, that vibrant abstract vision just turns into a useless, opaque brown puddle. You have to calculate the viscosity of the polymers, the density of the specific pigments, and the exact drying times. And the artist mastered all of this in a very specific environment, which was his studio in Whittier, California.
Yeah, and the dossier describes that Whittier studio almost like a semiconductor clean room.
It really does.
It's climate controlled, aseptic, completely sealed off from the unpredictability of the real world. That is where the scientific calibration of these chemical mixtures actually happens. But the twist in the source material, and this is wild to me, is that he doesn't paint Okash in that sterile lab.
No, he doesn't.
He takes this highly calibrated, mathematically precise chemical knowledge and transports his entire operation outdoors to a patio in Huntington Beach.
And that decision, I mean, it changes the physical behavior of the polymers entirely.
Yeah.
He is working outside, entirely exposed to the elements. And crucially, he isn't using an easel.
Wait, so he's just working on a flat surface, manually tilting it?
He has to. He is relying on varying weather conditions to manipulate the paint, which results in this high-speed, diagonal clash of incredibly intense colors.
I have to push back on the logic of that setup, though.
Okay, go ahead.
If you spend years figuring out the exact viscosity and drying times of these chemicals in a climate-controlled room, taking them outside feels like trying to build a massive house of cards on a vibrating table.
That's a great way to put it.
You are introducing wind, humidity, heat. So how does the weather actually change the physical behavior of these polymers without just, you know, ruining the chemistry he perfected?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the artist isn't surrendering to the vibrating table. He's using the vibrations to build the house.
Oh, I see.
This is what the sources refer to as a deliberate open process. Let's look at the actual physics of what happens on that patio. Acrylics are basically water-based emulsions. So when you take them outside into the Huntington Beach sun, the heat accelerates the evaporation of the water base on the very top layer of the paint.
Oh, so it forms a skin on top while the paint underneath is still liquid.
That is exactly the mechanism. A rapid skin forms on the surface. Then, the coastal wind hits the canvas, and the wind doesn't just blow paint around it, creates subsurface shear.
Subsurface shear.
Yeah, it forces the liquid trapped beneath that rapid drying skin to move around, creating these microcurrents. And because Duke is working flat and tilting the canvas manually, gravity forces the heavier metallic pigments to drag violently through the lighter pigments without mixing into them.
That is wild. So the environment is basically acting as a brush, but the chemistry prevents the colors from collapsing into mud.
Precisely.
It's like he built a high-performance engine in the lab specifically to see if it could survive off-roading in the mud and the rain. So the mastery lies in building a chemical system robust enough to survive the unpredictability of the patio.
And it does survive, but barely.
Yeah.
The clash of reds and blacks constantly borders on complete visual disaster, but it is entirely orchestrated. Or, well, at least it was orchestrated until the other variable on the patio introduced itself.
Yes, the physical rupture that changes the destiny of this painting entirely.
The dog.
Exactly. The sources introduce Gracie, the house dog. While the canvas is still wet, while this delicate, high-speed diagonal clash of reds and blacks is essentially still a volatile liquid ecosystem, Gracie just walks right across it.
Just steps right on it.
She leaves a single, luminous, involuntary white paw print right in the middle of all that chromatic chaos.
And that single paw print sparks the central debate across our sources. We see two very distinct camps analyzing this exact moment.
Because it's so polarizing.
Very. One camp looks at the paw print and views it as an interruption that damages the purity of the technical achievement.
Yeah.
To them, Ocash was meant to be a flawless fine arts instruction manual in fluid dynamics.
And the dog just like scribbled in crayon over the most important page.
Basically, yes. But the other camp, which the artist's own text heavily leans into, argues that this print actually elevates the canvas. It moves the painting from a cold, sterile exercise in spatial exploration into a living, breathing, emotional archive.
Let me see if I can put this into a different context for you, the listener. I keep thinking about recording music. Say you are recording a complex, highly technical acoustic guitar melody in a perfectly soundproofed studio.
Okay, have fun.
It takes 50 takes, but you finally get the flawless version. Then you decide you want to play it on the street for a live recording. Right as you hit the final delicate chord, a passing ambulance siren blares, but it happens to harmonize flawlessly with your guitar.
Oh, that's a brilliant comparison.
Does that recording start being yours, or does the intrusion of the world make it something entirely new?
I mean, the ambulance siren breaks the formal score you were trying to play, much like Gracie's paw print shatters the pristine, controlled isolation of the artwork. But in breaking the score, it documents an exact, unrepeatable millisecond of reality.
Right, it anchors it.
Abstract art, by its very nature, often prides itself on not narrating anything literal. It deals in color, shape, and energy, kind of avoiding biography entirely.
It wants to be universal, not specific.
Exactly. But when the dog steps on the canvas, the pointing stops being just a demonstration of polymer viscosities. It
Yeah.
becomes a territory of profound vulnerability. It absorbs a life. This single accidental mark forces this abstract space to hold a literal biography. It proves the art actually existed in the real world, not just in a vacuum.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting, because I want to challenge this idea that the accident is the only thing that gives the piece value.
Okay, let's hear it.
Let's go back to my acoustic guitar metaphor for a second. If I don't know how to play the guitar at all, and I'm just making awful, disjointed noise on the street, an ambulance siren driving by doesn't magically turn my noise into a masterpiece.
No, definitely not.
It's just bad guitar playing, plus a siren. So, apply to the painting. If Duke's underlying technique was garbage, like if he hadn't mastered the fluid dynamics and just made a giant puddle of chromatic mud on the patio, wouldn't the footprint just be a dog stepping on a piece of trash destined for the dumpster?
That's a very fair point.
Right. Doesn't the intense technical mastery of the artist actually validate the accident?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you are hitting on the exact synthesis that makes Ocash so important in the visual analysis source. The accident absolutely does not save a bad painting.
Thank you.
The reason the paw print works conceptually and visually is because the canvas was already an organized chaos of fluid
It
dynamic.
was uniquely predisposed to absorb the real world.
Yes, because Duke designed a visual ecosystem that emulated the speed and unpredictability of nature. When a piece of actual nature, the dog, impacted it, The artwork didn't visually collapse, it assimilated the rupture.
It just absorbed it seamlessly.
The chemical calibration, those years in the Whittier studio, that is the language. The paw print is simply a brilliant, surprising word spoken in that language. If the language was broken, the word would have no meaning.
The mastery builds the stage robust enough to hold the weight of the accident.
Exactly.
But I'm curious how this fits into the broader timeline of art history, because incorporating accidents into poured paint isn't exactly a 21st century invention. Any listener familiar with mid-20th century abstract expressionism is probably thinking of Jackson Pollock right now.
Oh, absolutely. You cannot talk about poured paint and accidents without bringing Pollock into the conversation.
Right.
In the 1940s and 50s, Pollock famously laid his massive canvases on the floor of his barn and just aggressively dripped in poured paint. His most famous works, like Autumn Rhythm, are full of celebrated accidents.
Didn't he leave stuff in the paint?
He did. If you look closely at the surface of his paintings, they have cigarette ash, dust, and even dead insects permanently embedded in the paint.
So how is a dog stepping on Duke's canvas in 2021 philosophically any different from Pollock dropping a cigarette into wet paint in 1950? I mean, it feels like the exact same type of intrusion.
Well, the sources highlight a massive ontological difference between the two. When Pollock drops cigarette ash into his paint, that accident was entirely anthropocentric.
Meaning it was driven by the human at the center of it all?
Correct. Pollock's ash was a biological extension of his own ego, his own vices, and his own physical pacing around the canvas. The ash was really just another trace of the human artist asserting his presence and control, even through his mistakes.
Huh. I never thought of it that way.
It reinforces the myth of the genius creator who dominates the canvas. But Gracie's paw print is fundamentally different because it is a non-human interspecies collaboration.
So it bypasses the artist's ego entirely.
To explain why this matters, the visual analysis brings in the philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce and his concept of the index.
The index.
Yeah, in semiotics, an index is a sign that is physically caused by its object. Smoke is an index of fire. A shadow is an index of the sun. A footprint is an index of a foot.
Okay, that makes sense.
So Gracie's paw print is an indexical mark. It is a direct, tactile trace of a living being that has zero interest in art history, zero interest in color theory, and zero intention of making a statement.
And no amount of practice in that Whittier studio could have ever choreographed the exact morphological weight, the texture of the dog's paw pad, or the precise, random placement of that step.
It is entirely outside the realm of human control. The artist literally has to step back and let the indexical mark dictate the final reality of the piece. Pollock's ash says, "I was here." Gracie's paw print says, "The world is here and it does not care about your plans."
Wow. Which brings us to the ultimate question for the future. Having established this dual brilliance, the rigorous underlying technique, and the profound egoless accident, what lesson does this actually teach the next generation of artists?
That's the big question.
Because Okash isn't just existing in a vacuum. The artist's reflective text suggests it is sending a ripple forward.
It is. The sources outline two diverging predictions for how Okash will influence the future of the avant-garde. The first prediction focuses entirely on a methodological triumph.
Meaning?
Meaning future creators will study Duke's ability to bridge the gap between sterile studio control and outdoor chaos.
They will focus on the chemistry side of things.
Right. They will study how he pushed the boundaries of fluid mechanics, how he managed that rapid skin formation and subsurface shear without creating visual mud. They will see Okash as permission to abandon the safety of the studio and push the raw materiality of paint to its absolute physical limits out in the open world, trying to master the hurricane, essentially.
Okay, so prediction one is all about replicating the physical survival of the paint. What is prediction two?
Prediction two is a massive conceptual shift. This view argues that abstract painting has, in many ways, become overly decorative over the last few decades.
Oh, interesting.
It has devolved into a repetition of safe aesthetic forms that look good in a corporate lobby, but just don't carry any emotional or philosophical weight.
It's sterile, like it's gone back into the clean room and just stayed there.
Exactly. So this prediction suggests that future artists will look at Okash and realize that technique isn't enough anymore. They will actively start to design accidents.
Design accidents?
Yeah, they will intentionally create contexts for vulnerability, trying to capture that real-world, indexical presence on the canvas. They will care less about perfect color clashes and more about turning their canvases into emotional archives that document the intrusion of life.
So what does this all mean? Because if a future artist explicitly designs a context for an accident to happen, Isn't that just the ultimate artistic ego trip?
Oh.
I mean, if you put your canvas on the floor specifically hoping a dog or a person or a leaf falls on it, you aren't actually surrendering control. You are basically trying to choreograph randomness. It feels entirely counter to the genuine surprise that makes the paw print in Okash so special. You can't fake a lack of intention.
This raises an important question about how art actually evolves. Art history rarely advances through smooth, logical continuities. It advances through ruptures. What makes Okash such a pivotal piece of source material is that it embodies both continuity and rupture simultaneously.
Explain how it functions as both.
Well, it is the glorious continuation of a very long, very serious formalist tradition. It honors the history of color theory, of fluid mechanics, and of the physical properties of paint. It proves that the human mind can master the most volatile elements of chemistry.
The continuity part.
Right. But at the exact same time, it is a violent rupture against the history of the medium. Since the Renaissance, painting has desperately tried to be timeless. It tries to freeze a moment forever, to transcend biology and decay.
Yeah, I see where you're going with this.
But this painting captures the finite, mortal biology of an animal. It traps a heartbeat in a medium that desperately wants to be immortal. Whether future artists try to copy the chemistry or awkwardly attempt to choreograph the accident, they are ultimately responding to that friction between the timeless and the mortal.
It really is a delicate balancing act. To synthesize everything we've pulled from the dossier, the visual analysis, and the artist's own reflections today, it seems the historical success of Okash isn't just about the paint, and it isn't just about the dog.
No, it's bigger than that.
It is its profound ability to exist in two entirely different dimensions at the exact same time. It is a violent, meticulous exercise in chemical control, and simultaneously, it is a deeply personal, entirely silent emotional archive.
It is the Whittier Lab and the Huntington Beach patio locked in a permanent embrace. You just cannot have the profound impact of the accident without the rigorous foundation of the chemistry to hold it.
And there is a real-world lesson in that for you listening right now. In our own lives, in our careers, in the projects we build, we so often strive for that Whittier studio perfection.
We do.
We want the climate control. We want to calibrate every variable, predict every outcome, and eliminate every risk so that nothing can possibly go wrong. We think true mastery is building an impenetrable fortress around our work and our lives. We think the goal is to keep the messy world out.
But the indexical mark on this canvas suggests the exact opposite approach to mastery.
True mastery might not be about preventing the accident. True mastery might just be having the courage and the underlying structural rigor to build something so robust that you can let the unpredictable, messy, real world walk all over it and trust that the intrusion will only make the final result richer.
Which leaves us with one final, very provocative thought to consider, especially as we look toward the future of how images are made.
Okay, what is it?
We are rapidly entering an era where artificial intelligence is generating synthetic art. These systems are capable of replicating any technique, running any fluid dynamic simulation, and faking any chemical interaction perfectly.
Right.
A machine can render the visual data of a dog's paw print in a millisecond. But the entire value of Okash lies in the fact that it is a physical index, a literal biological trace of a living creature bypassing human. Will what happens to the value of mistakes in the future?
Oh, yeah.
Can a machine generating a synthetic accident ever replicate the profound emotional weight of a true biological rupture? Or will true artistic vulnerability, the kind that transforms an instruction manual into an archive, always require a heartbeat?
It makes you wonder what we are actually valuing when we look at a masterpiece. The next time you spend years in your own sterile lab perfecting a project, eliminating every error, maybe you shouldn't lock the door to keep the world out. Maybe you should crack it open, step back, and just wait to see if the dog walks in.